What's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Davidson Hang podcast, where I get to interview amazing people and help share their wisdom with the world. Let me know your takeaways and feel free to connect with the guests. I'm aiming to build a community around coaching, self-development, leadership, where people are not afraid to be their most authentic versions of themselves. You can find us on video by searching the Davidson Hang podcast on YouTube. Welcome and enjoy the ride. Hey everyone, I'm excited to bring to you Mark Hunter, who's a professional certified coach.
Master certified coach now.
Oh, you're a master, you're MCC now?
I'm MCC now, yes. Thanks.
When did that happen?
Let's see. Actually, it's been 3 years now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Since the program.
That's right. That's right.
I apologize. Yeah, that's pretty, that's awesome.
Thank you.
Thing. Yeah, I think one of my goals is to get like the PCC. I don't know about MCC. That's a little ambitious, but you know, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so you're the owner of Pinnacle Coaching, and you also you're still running Accomplishment Coaching programs, right?
Yes, so I'm a senior leader with Accomplishment Coaching.
Yeah, and you also do, I'm sure, a million other things as well, right?
I still do. Yes.
Yeah, well, you mean a lot to me, and honestly, from the bottom of my heart, like the program, honestly, was a pivotal point for me. Like, I would say it was the point where I started realizing, like, started having awareness and more intentionality around my life. And yeah, AC has done a lot. I feel like I it's crazy to think that from 3 years ago to now, like I don't even think I could imagine the man I've become in such a relatively short amount of time. So thank you so much for everything. And, you know, I know you started it in New York, right? I believe.
Yes.
So, you know, there's been hundreds and hundreds of coaches who have then transformed. Because I feel like I impact thousands. So I can't even imagine like the hundreds times thousands. That's like, so you're responsible for 100,000 people at least.
I sure hope so. I do hope that that ripple effect is making a difference for people that I've never met and never will meet. Definitely.
Yeah. And the cool thing about this podcast is like, even, you know, 100 years from now, like what, who knows, like you might live that long, but let's just say if you don't, your lessons will still live on. So that to me is pretty cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I wanted to, so, you know, what's going on right now, there's a lot of stuff going on. So for people who are listening to this much later, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. And on top of that, there's a lot of racial issues that people are dealing with, society is finally dealing with. So there's just a lot going on and a lot more uncomfortable conversations that people aren't used to having, especially in corporate America. I'm fortunate enough where I work at LinkedIn, and we're pretty, we're able to have create these spaces where we can have these conversations, but it's still uncomfortable, right? There's still a lot of people who are paralyzed and not really sure what to do, or they don't want to look bad by saying something, so they're kind of silent. So there's just a lot going on right now. So just to give people context who might be listening to this in a much different time period. There's a lot going on in the world right now. Yeah, so I wanted to get your perspective, because as an executive, as someone who's gone through corporate America, you know, I'm Asian American, right? So I don't know what it's like. You know, I've encountered like some of my own microaggressions, but would love to hear like from your perspective. I mean, that's like a pretty loaded question. But I guess, like, why do you think it's taken us this long to finally have these conversations?
That's a big question. I think it's because the conversation itself is so uncomfortable, and we sort of gravitate away from it because it means facing some, it means, you know, especially white America facing some real truths about the past that are inconvenient and unpleasant. So I think that you know, just because of our addiction to comfort and our addiction to feeling safe and, you know, feeling good about ourselves, I think there's a resistance to actually taking a good hard look and having this tough conversation because it would require taking a look over here first. And, you know, we've talked so much about that in the coach training program about the value of self-awareness, but that's a tough pill to swallow. So I think the reason that we haven't had the conversation that we've needed to have as a nation is that it's simply unpleasant. And it's easier to avoid and to pretend that that's all in the past or that that's not me or denial, basically. It's much easier to deny.
Yeah, I can certainly relate because even for me, like I've denied a lot of like how I haven't really been an ally for my, you know, my Black brothers and sisters, right? Like just kind of even going through the program, a lot of that came up for a lot of like my fellow people that we've gone through this year-long coaching. And even then I kind of got it, but I still didn't get it. You know, like I think 30% of it resonated with me, but I was kind of like, well, I have my own like stuff to worry about. Right. So so even for me, like, you know, I didn't really take the action by reading books like White Fragility or by, you know, watching documentaries like The 13th, like into more recently, I started diving into, you know, MLK's biography, Malcolm. Like, and it was funny because in the past I've read Arthur Ashe's biography and Muhammad Ali's biography, but for some reason those chapters are less memorable for me. Like it was like I tuned it out in a way. Yes. You know, so acknowledging that for me was like even like a pretty big awakening.
Yeah, and I think that's the first part of having these conversations is being willing to acknowledge the resistance to having the conversation, right? And being willing to go have them anyway. And it's really a willingness conversation because everybody can have this conversation, but you've got to be willing to take a look in those tough places.
Yeah, because I in Robin's class or in her book, she talks a lot about because sometimes people relate it to morality thing, right? It's like, well, that means I'm a bad person. It's like, no, we're not saying you're a bad person. We're just, you know, so I think a lot of times people get defensive because they think, oh, it then automatically means like you're a bad person.
Right. Yeah, she talks about the evolution of that word racism and that, you know, being a racist is a negative thing somehow as opposed to something that, you know, just occurs in people. It's not, you know, it's not something that's necessarily right or wrong or morally judged, but it's just a fact. It's a fact of existence. And she, you know, but there's a big conversation about race to unpack there, right? I mean, first you have to remember that racism is a system. It's a system of oppression. It's a system of hierarchy and privilege. It's not about the individual necessarily. The individual benefits from that system. That's where racism comes from.
So being a executive coach, like, what are your thoughts on being empowered individually versus like more systematic things, right? Because I often find myself clashing between, you know, sometimes I'm like, well, it's much more empowering to think of, but then I'm almost like discounting that there's this whole system that exists, right? So I often find myself trapped between though, how can I impact change on a more macro level versus like, how can I just be responsible for myself and who I'm being in the world, right? So for me, I kind of find that clash sometimes.
Yeah. I think the challenge is not to relate to those things as an either or, right? You know, it's individual willingness to take a stand, individual willingness to have your voice heard and to be introspective and take a look at your own contribution or privilege. I think that's not in opposition to, you know, taking a look at the system and how it's broken. In fact, I think they're both required. If you're going to make a difference on a macro level in an organization, in your community, or in the global community even, it has to start with personal responsibility first. You have to take a look over here at what we do and at how my privilege or my my benefiting from this system is a contribution to the system itself. And I think that has to happen before the system can be changed.
Hmm. Yeah. And even as like an Asian American male living in New York City, like I also have like my own privileges as well, right? And at first it was hard for me to admit that I have privilege as well, right? But at the end of the day, like I do have it, but it, you know, even acknowledging that, I feel like it's still hard for me sometimes.
It's not easy, right? I mean, to acknowledge privilege, it means also acknowledging that you've benefited from that privilege in an unfair way, right? And that's not a good feeling, you know, factual or not. It's just not a good feeling. And I think I think that's one of the bigger challenges also, is that on an individual level, we don't like, people don't like to admit their contribution to a problem. They also don't like to take a look at how they've benefited from that problem's existence.
Yeah, I feel like a good analogy, because I was trying to explain this to my friend, because I feel like now we're all having this conversation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, well, you know, if you're getting a start, if it's a 100-meter race and you're getting a start at the 40-yard line, and then you're going to, and then, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, or if you win, you win $1 million, like, of course, like, you're going to want to start at the 40 versus, like, starting at the negative 10-yard line, right? It's like, in my, you know, why would you want, so then, you know, I try to explain it, but it's still tough. Like, a lot of people still don't, you know, people start saying, well, I just still don't see, like, what's the point in riots? Like, I'm like, well, yeah, but it's all material stuff. Like, it's all money, right? At the end of the day, like, money versus actual human lives, like, that's not as important. Human lives are much more valuable, right? But then some people get caught up, I feel like, in the content, you know, more than the content.
Yeah, that conversation, that question about riots is a tough one, right? I mean, it's on, you know, on the surface, it's easy to sort of sit back from far away and say, hey, that's wrong.
Right.
I believe Martin Luther King is quoted as having said that rioting is the voice of the oppressed, or the language of the oppressed. And, you know, the unfortunate fact of the matter is that this conversation didn't get big and mainstream until there was uncivil unrest in the streets. So unfortunately, no one was listening before.
Right.
And now everybody is. So is rioting right or wrong? I don't think that's a valuable conversation. It is actually effective. It actually made a difference. And again, I don't think it's a right or wrong thing. I think it's just that if a group of people are marginalized and oppressed for long enough and they are left with no options, then this becomes their only option. Then I don't know that it makes sense to blame their action so much as to blame the system that had them not listened to way back when they were speaking quietly and responsibly and loudly and no one was listening. I think that's the conversation to have, that people aren't having enough.
Do you think, because I do think like media controls so much, and you know, I think I remember seeing, like, there was a stat, I think, in Robin's book where she said like 90s, it's like something ridiculous, like in the high 90% controls like Hollywood and a lot of the media, right? Like the people that control what programs, like America, right? And they have so much influence. So how do you tap into, when you're often the first person, when you're often, you know, trying to break through the glass ceiling, and you're often, you know, the only person, and you don't have a lot of role models that look like you in that, right? Like, being the first, I feel like, is always really hard. But how do you, I guess, you know, I mean, that's like a pretty loaded question, but you know, I feel like, you know, a lot about leadership, and I feel like it is hard when you're often like the only one, right?
Yeah. Or do you mean inside of an organization? Like, how do you actually navigate the inside of an organization when you're the only minority?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I have a lot of personal experience with this. You know, in I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in a very diverse community in the 70s and 80s and 90s. But my time spent in corporate America, both as an employee and as an executive and as a coach, I'm very often the only African-American person in the room. And that is tough. It's not comfortable. You know, I think that it requires a commitment to something bigger than our comfort, though. I have a lot of people tell me, people of color tell me that, hey, you know, like, how can you be the only person in the room? Like, that seems ridiculous. Why are you still there? Or why are you doing what you're doing? And, you know, I've had that historically over the years. And I don't know that anything changes if we're not willing, if someone's not willing to actually take on that discomfort. And, you know, I don't relate to myself as, you know, changing the world necessarily, but I think that being seen as a person of color, as a black man in an entirely white organization, historically has made a difference for the people that see me. I've gotten feedback that it actually makes a difference for people to see me in that role. And it I guess you could call it breaking the glass ceiling, but it's also being willing to be in uncomfortable and unfamiliar surroundings and have that be okay, quote unquote, like not have to go escape and go get comfortable again. And I think that over the long haul, those decisions that people make to go be the one person that stands out, the outlier, the person that's challenging a norm, I think that enough people doing that is what makes change happen. You know, it's what's happened with the women's movement, you know, you name it, LGBTQ community, like actually being willing to be seen for who you are in a place where you typically haven't been represented or welcome. I think it matters.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think too often, you know, we, because being uncomfortable, what are your thoughts on, because if you're uncomfortable all the time, do you lose a sense of your identity, or do you lose a sense of your past? Because I do think there's that sense of adapting to your surroundings where you kind of have to be a certain way to almost fit in, right? To be part of the club. So where do you find that balance of still being yourself, but still being almost a chameleon where that's they can receive even some of the communication sometimes?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a conversation about comfort and another conversation about inclusion. Mm-hmm. But my theory about comfort is that, you know, life is not comfortable. In fact, comfort is a danger to leaders. Comfort is a death sentence to people who actually want to make a difference. You can't make a difference if you're chasing comfort. Mm-hmm. My experience and opinion as a coach, and as a person too. So I actually don't think that being willing to be uncomfortable sort of as a lifestyle has to be in opposition to being yourself. In fact, I would assert the opposite, that if you're chasing comfort, sort of, you know, and this is especially in Western culture, is something that we're fed constantly, right? More comfort, more stuff, more, you know, more ease, right? Having everything be easy and automated. I think that actually gets us further and further away from who we actually are. So I think that embracing the discomfort of life, whatever that discomfort is, you know, is a way of actually getting closer to who we are. So we're not running away from the discomfort of the places that there are to look to find out more about ourselves. So again, just the bottom line, I think that comfort is access to knowing ourselves more. I'm sorry, discomfort is access to knowing ourselves more intimately and vulnerably. Hmm. Now, that being said, to your second question about inclusion, yeah, I think that it can be a trap, right? I mean, there's a term called I forgot the name of it, but when you are code switching. Sorry, I apologize for the delay. Code switching is a way of trying to get comfortable in an unfamiliar setting. Code switching, if you're not familiar with the term, is when you start to switch into the vernacular of the group that you're in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm from Brooklyn. You know, I have a Brooklyn accent, and I can talk like I'm from Brooklyn when I'm comfortable and at ease and hanging out with my brother or my friends from Brooklyn. But I've learned over time, especially being in almost all white rooms where I work, to speak differently, to speak more carefully, to speak more measuredly around, you know, my use of English and the way I and be very articulating and intentional. So that can look like, that can be code switching, right? Where I'm actually switching the way I talk based on who I'm talking to. Now, the challenge is that, yeah, that can start to feel like, well, I'm not really being myself. I'm not really being authentic.
Yeah.
And it's an unfortunate thing that especially I notice Black people have learned to do in order to survive. You know, this is not just a comfort thing. It feels like a survival thing. But it also can get in the way of being true to ourselves. So it has to be something you're aware of that you're doing. I think that's the key. You got to know that you're doing it and why you're doing it. And those two things have your doing it not be necessarily in opposition to who you are as a person. Otherwise, you know, it just devolves into performing for somebody else and trying to manage the way they think and try to control what they feel about you. And that's when it starts to get messy and dangerous.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I do notice the way I talk with my friends, my boys, when we're all just hanging out, is way different than how I talk in corporate America sometimes, you know?
Yeah, me too. Definitely, yeah.
The funniest way, sometimes people will call me on the phone, I'll pick up, and they're like, is that Davidson? They're like, yeah. Well, I had no idea you talk like that.
Yep.
But it's just interesting to see that, you know. But to your point, it's a way of survival, right? Because if I... you know, during my interview process, if I talked like a certain way, they might be like, well, that's weird. Like, where are you from? Like, where did you grow up? You know, like it right. just, it's just unnecessary sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's something that I think that, that people do that I've done in order to fit in to your point. And it's something though that I've always been aware of doing. It's not a, an accident or something that, that is, that's happening unconsciously. But it's important to know, like I said, why you're doing it. Because otherwise it just becomes something that, that that's unintentional and habitual.
Yeah. And I'm curious, because you do work with a lot of executives. Are the conversations of diversity, inclusion, and belonging more prevalent now that, you know, people are starting to take a look at, like, at the company level? Like, have you been noticing that being a topic of discussion with a lot of your clients?
Much more now, especially in the past 3 or 4 weeks since the murder of George Floyd. So yes, absolutely. And it's another thing, not just diversity, equity, inclusion as sort of general ideas, but the more intimate sort of vulnerable conversation about how can I be an ally? Hmm. You know, how can I make a difference? What can I do? There have been questions that I've been asked almost daily.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. Yeah. Yes. I think there are people really see that, that I want to do something and I want to make a difference. I want to be a contribution to this. I don't want to be part of the problem anymore. And you know, there's sort of a critical mass we've reached as a country, where not just Black people are fed up, but Americans, including white Americans, are fed up. And we've reached that tipping point where enough have said, you know, that they're fed up, that their voices, our voices are being heard. And I think that's really important to remember, is that, that this conversation about allyship and partnership around this type of shift in this movement is key. It's why it works. It's why it's actually working now. Mm.
This is a pretty loaded question, but what are your thoughts on like the dynamics of power? Because I do think with the police force, I think it just comes down to like a power dynamic, right? Like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like, because in a way, I feel like America has gotten to where we are because of the military strength and like a lot of like the brutality aspect of like, we're Americans, you know, we solve all the problems. But in a way, it's like, that's why we're in this situation too, right? Because we just force our way into everything and try to control like everything.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there with the control word. You know, you can look back at the history of the police in this country. I mean, they were the history of the police forces in this country that actually go all the way back to slave times when they were around to hunt down runaway slaves. And some of that contextual cultural stuff still lives in some police departments. Obviously not all police are bad, and that's a crazy statement. But the idea of protect and serve, which is what I think the sort of the motto of most police departments, to protect and serve, has been sort of co-opted into control and manage. So to your point, I think that the intention to control a population, and especially a specific part of the population, to try to control and manage just part of the population that way, or anybody that way, is never going to work long term. You know, human beings are not built to be controlled. You know, so there's a natural resistance to that that's going to come up. And especially when it's a specific marginalized group that's bearing the brunt of that control and manage. So I think that, you know, the militarization of the police and, you know, the hyper funding of the police is something that has contributed to some of that control and manage context. But it needs to be returned to a protect and serve context ultimately. And it needs to include protecting and serving everyone. Now, growing up as a kid, I was taught by my life experience, but also by grown-ups around me, especially Black people around me, that, you know, the police are not necessarily there to protect and serve me. Yeah. And that's because of the color of my skin, not because it did anything wrong, but, you know, that I need to be as careful with them as I need to be with anybody that I run into on the street, because I don't know who I can trust. Just because they're wearing a blue uniform doesn't mean that they're there for me. And in fact, I was taught a little bit towards the direction of be careful of them. Because, you know, you really don't know how it's going to go, and it's not necessarily going to go in your favor.
It's crazy to think, like, I guess I'm also curious, like, and it's probably a similar answer, but why has it taken us this long to realize that the police force is, you know what I mean? Like, like, how come it's 2020 and we're finally realizing maybe we're funding way too many police and like they probably have way too much power?
Well, again, the funding, defunding the police conversation is a little tricky, and I can't comment too much on that. But to your question about why it's taken so long, you know, we all have cameras on our phones now. And this has been going on for a long time. So long before I got here. And I think that what's happening now is that it's in your face. So it can't be ignored the way it used to be ignored. Can't happen on a street where there are other people and not be circulated now. You know, it used to have to happen in front of a news crew or witnesses, and those witnesses were never believed, especially if they were African American. So the trick is that to remember that none of this is new. You know, the police, yes, have become hyper militarized in recent years and decades, but there's always been this conflict that's just been under the radar, and people weren't listening because it seemed like, you know, there really wasn't that much of it because people weren't looking for it necessarily. It's much more comfortable to pretend that you know, the civil rights movement was in the 60s somehow and that's over. We had a black president. You hear all these excuses and reasons and denials of racism still existing, but you can't ignore video. And I think that's the reason why it's up now and the conversation can't be ignored anymore.
So yeah, as much as I hate on technology, I guess in a way it has like democratized. There's more transparency, I guess, in general across a lot of different things because, you know, like you said, everyone has a camera, right? So stuff will surface because now, you know, you can record anything. So
yeah, and everybody has access to information too. You know, like the great equalizer is information. Really. And the video is just part of it. But, you know, we can look up, you know, statistics and history at the tip of our fingers. Literally, we have a computer in our pocket. And that is new. You know, when I was a kid, our phones were still attached to the wall. And, you know, you couldn't get information like that unless you went to a library and read a book that was written by a very specific group of people to send a very specific message. So it was tough to actually get an unedited sort of unwhitewashed version of history. And now you can get all that stuff instantly.
I mean, it does bring me hope that there are more white allies now, right? Because I mean, for the most part, like I can only speak from my experience, but I was always like, I've always had compassion for like blacks and Hispanics and minorities, right? Because I was always like, you know, I see it, right? Because even if it was a smaller percentage of like microaggressions, racism, I still felt some, so I was able to relate. But I feel like what's mind-blowing for me, and maybe I work at LinkedIn, so maybe that's even biased, but I'm seeing a lot more allies now that are like actually acknowledging the white privilege and saying all these things. I'm like, what? I did not see that coming. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't expect like Warren Buffett and all these really powerful people to acknowledge him. Like, whoa, like that's crazy to me.
Yeah. You know, some of it, I think, is because of that tipping point I mentioned earlier. There's enough people who've seen this now and the horror, especially the horror of George Floyd's death and how it went, that it can't really be ignored the same way before. But there's a portion of that has probably got to do more with peer pressure and political pressure than necessarily truly wanting to make a difference, especially big organizations. Like, I think there's almost like their silence is deafening. In times like this. So, you know, I think we need to balance out the good news with the understanding that some of this is simply damage control, some of it's PR, and yes, you're right. Like, it's actually making a difference that there are all these powerful white voices being heard, and especially the collective numbers of white voices that are being heard now alongside black voices. I think that is actually why this is being made a difference, because the discomfort is not just in the black community anymore. Now it's all across the country, and doesn't matter what color you are, there's discomfort everywhere. And that discomfort is what I assert is making a difference now, not necessarily, you know, just the discomfort of black people, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably going to be, and you can answer like as much, because I hear like it's often traumatic to go back in the past and look at like very clear examples. But I guess like working for big companies when you're in reinsurance and like when you were in corporate America, and I'm sure now, but like, what were some of the very clear moments where you're kind of just like, okay, you know, we have a long way to go? Or I guess what were some of those like breaking points where you almost were just like, you know, like this is just too much for me to handle, you know?
Yeah. I think the first thing is, of course, walking into an office where you work and being the only person that looks like you. I think that fundamentally, that one thing has you feel separate and alone. But additionally, there are microaggressions and not so microaggressions also, some very explicit aggressions too. Things, off-color jokes, being excluded, like being like the only person excluded from things happening, both business and recreational things happening with people in the office. Mm-hmm. So some of those things happened on a regular basis, and they happen so much that you just don't even, you know, you don't even notice them anymore. You can't react to all of them. So, you know, it's tough to say that here's the one thing, but all of them sort of fit into that thread that I stuck out because I was not like everybody else. I didn't look like everybody else. And, you know, and I think that's probably the biggest thing that I think affected all the rest. And from there, it's also people, you know, the people, this was back in the 90s too. Like there was a lot of discomfort with conversations about race. So there was a lot of side conversation that I would overhear about the black guy, and I was referred to as the black guy and things like that. And that's how I was, you know, recognized. But then of course there was encounters with the police. There were encounters with people on the streets too. Like just, you know, names being called to me or being accused of stuff, especially like being pulled over by the police for reasons that I still don't know. And being questioned and detained and held for no reason. So there are things like that happen that are, you know, that accumulate over time. And yeah, it starts to wear on you. And I think the danger is that it starts to become numb. And you start to get numb to it. It's like, oh, this is happening again. Okay. And that's where that resignation that comes with the numbness gets dangerous, because then you're not doing anything about it. Then you start to accept some of the things that are happening. And I think that's where some of the change starts to calcify. And we stop moving forward, and we start to just sort of settle into, you know, being resigned to how it's going to go.
Wow, that's powerful. Thanks for sharing, Mark. It kind of reminded me. I just watched on Amazon, Just Mercy.
Ah, yes.
And the part that really like resonated with me was when he, Walter, the main character, who's played by Jamie Foxx, there was a point where it was much later. He was tried for murdering this white female, which he didn't. And he's like, sometimes, like, you know, when you're in jail for that long, after 10 years, you start to question like your own, like, did I actually do it? Like, am I a horrible person? Like, I thought I'd been like I don't think I did it, but who knows? Like, maybe I did do it. And it's like, you start to really question. It's like, clearly he didn't. But after you hearing that and being in the system, being in jail, your identity eventually morphs into this person who's like, who he wasn't, right? But it's just that the systems and everything, he's sort of just like, man, like maybe I did do it, but you know, so it really like that resonated with me. I'm like, damn, that's deep, you know?
Yeah. And I've never been to prison, obviously, but but being told over and over again that you're a threat, being told over and over again, treated like a threat. You start to believe it, like, you know, just living your life, being constantly related to as dangerous and as untrustworthy, it starts to feel like maybe it's true, you know, to your point, like maybe there is something about me, not just the color of my skin, that makes me that way. And it's heartbreaking to experience that. It's important that we keep remembering that that's not the truth. It's just something that we're being told systemically.
And it's crazy too, because like I've heard it so many times, like in Landmark, I would hear stories, and then it's usually, I don't know, like maybe it takes like a few times for it to like actually sink in, right? Like first you hear it a couple times and you're kind of just like, oh, maybe that was just a one-time occurrence, or maybe it's just, you know, but then after you hear it like 10, 15 times, you're like, all right, like it's definitely, you know, there's something here, right? And it's interesting how sometimes it takes a bunch of times for it to actually sink in, you know, yeah. Like as someone who's not Black, like,
it, yeah.
You know. Wow. Yeah, I do. And maybe like this is like a way overly optimistic way to look at it. But like, do you feel like it's made you such a stronger person in terms of like you're more resilient, like you have more grit and you have like thicker skin so that you're able to, because of that, like your work ethic and like because you had to work harder essentially to get to where you are now. Do you feel like in a way it's sort of like, how do I say this? But I guess like for me, like I'm almost glad that I experienced a lot of racism and, you know, I didn't have a father and like I kind of moved around to like 30 different houses. Like I felt like if I didn't have all that, I wouldn't necessarily be as compassionate. I wouldn't really be as understanding of different circumstances, you know? So in a way I'm like, I not like I would wish it upon, but I think it's made me much more caring in general as a human being.
Yeah. Absolutely. I unequivocally, yes. I feel like those experiences taught me very young that I had to work hard in order to overcome not just, you know, my situation, but other people's perception of me. Mm. So that I could actually succeed in the world, especially in the white world. So yeah, I learned early on to, quite frankly, just learn to outwork people around me, you know, and that hard work was something that anybody could do, but very few people were willing to do. So if you're willing, then you can go create what you want to create. So I learned that lesson early and I took it to heart. So yeah, to your point, I learned I learned my work ethic early and I learned it from that unfortunate set of circumstances. But yeah, it has benefited me. It helped me survive, you know, growing up in Brooklyn in the 70s and 80s, which is not like the Brooklyn it is now. and actually to survive also in the white world once I got there too, right? To keep my wits about me, keep my eyes open, to be self-aware, to be situationally aware as well. So that I'm able to work hard, but I'm also able to be aware of my surroundings, both physical and sort of you know, contextual surroundings as well. Because those things are important. Yeah. I mean, you gotta be careful of you know, as a Black person growing up, I had to be careful of where I was and who I was making uncomfortable, whether I was doing anything wrong or not. And so that level of self-awareness is something I've taken with me and I still have. But yeah, it has actually, you know, one of the things I do and grateful for, especially having graduated from accomplishment coaching and having learned what I've learned, is that it had me open my heart rather than close it. Because an option, of course, when you're faced with that kind of a situation is to close your heart, right?
Yeah.
You know, screw everybody, like I'm on my own. And I think that I spent a good period of my life in that place. Took a lot of work to unlearn it. Uh-huh. And yeah, having an open heart, being able to have conversations like this about it without just sort of devolving into my anger is something that I had to learn because I couldn't for a long time. I just didn't talk about it for a long, long time in my life. It's just something I had to deal with. And, you know, I wasn't in any way going to share it with anybody. But I think it's important for, you know, you and I to have conversations like this so that, you know, we understand each other, so that you can understand, where this is coming from, where all the change and all the uncivil unrest in the streets is coming from, so that you can contribute to it if you choose to.
Right. Yeah. And there's many ways to contribute as well, right? Like my friend was saying, like doing things like this, right? It doesn't have to always be like marching, right? It could be like having these conversations. So there's a lot of different ways to contribute. And you know, cause sometimes like if this is like your first conversation ever, right? You don't necessarily have to like dive into the deep end, but you could start by, you know, maybe reading a biography, watching a documentary, like just a little bit more education that's more from a perspective of something that's not mainstream media, you know?
Absolutely. Yes. I want to add to that. I think it's a lot of education that needs to be done. You know, the education that we learned, you and I and every person in this country learned in school about race in this country was short and inauthentic. That's the nicest way of saying it. Mm. So my education, most of my education about the Black experience in this country has come from my own research, right? Like my own experience, some of it, but, you know, talking to my father, for example, who grew up on a farm in Louisiana in the 40s and 50s. Like that, you know, there's some firsthand experiences there, but also there's literature that you can read, right? There's all kinds of amazing books out there about the history of African Americans in this country and the history of slavery and some of the ugly stories and ugly truths. So yeah, that has to be sought out though. It's not something that is taught in public school naturally and openly, or I didn't learn it in college in an open and honest way either. So you have to do your own research. And I think a lot of it too. Like, the more self-education that can be done, the better, because once that amount of understanding is reached, it's impossible to forget. It's impossible to sort of go back to sleep. And I think it's important because it's a way of maintaining the discomfort with the way things are. Because we can't go back to normal. You know, I like to say that normal was broken. It got us here. You know, we have to stop trying to fight to get back to normal and hoping things quiet down some. We got to actually create a new normal that's inclusive and in a lot of ways actually makes the truth available to everybody.
And how do you suggest we implement this at a more like at the public school level, right? Because I mean, obviously, like you said, the education that we're getting in history class is filtered, right? It there's a lot of missing stuff. So like, I guess, how do we, because I feel like that's, you know, someone controls these things, right? Does that mean like people up there just have to be just more aware and they might have to just be proactive in challenging the status quo? Like, I feel like, yeah.
Good question. I think it does need to be taught at the you know, junior high school and high school levels, as well as collegiate level. But there are, you know, we have to actually revise all these reading lists. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful of the sort of whitewashed versions of history that we're teaching our kids. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way to do that is not necessarily through the school systems, because my understanding is that the states control reading lists and things like that individually. So, you know, it's based on what the state thinks is appropriate. I think it has to come down to parents. You know, I think parents have to be willing to take a stand and say, this is crap. Like, you know, this is not the whole truth. And parents have to be a demand that their kids be taught the whole inconvenient and uncomfortable, ugly truth about the history in this country. And that doesn't just mean Black history in this country and slavery. It includes, you know, what the genocide of Native Americans. You know, it includes the way the internment camps during World War II for Japanese Americans. So there's a lot of history that gets, you know, a little paragraph in some of these textbooks and gets skipped over. So I think parents need to be the ones to be a demand for their school systems to be sharing this with their kids. And if the school system won't, then parents need to be the ones to take action and make sure that their kids are educated in this early.
Right. But I also do think that eventually the states and the school systems will have to change as well, right? Because or else, like, I mean, that's probably going to take longer. But, you know, I do think to the point of like the systematic part, it's like that has to eventually change, right? Or else, like, people are just going to be ignorant, like, you know.
I'm wary of the term have to. It doesn't have to. It's been hundreds of years of telling this version of the story, the sort of whitewashed version of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the danger is that if we think, well, it's got to change, then we sort of relate to it as like it's naturally going to change or it's got to somehow passively change. I don't think that it has to. I think it needs to, but whether it does or not is really up to us. And so I think this conversation is important, and it's important to keep having and having with people who are in those positions to make decisions like that about school curriculum and willing to make those really uncomfortable, unpopular conversations in their communities.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, right? Anytime you challenge the status quo, because a lot of times like these school boards are often, right, like older white men who are benefiting from a lot of these, like, you know, systematic injustices, right? So it's like, why would we change? We're benefiting from this, you know? Yeah. So have you ever read a People's History, Howard Zinn's of People Histories of the United States?
No, I have not.
I feel like you would like that. Yeah.
Okay.
It's from the perspective of the Native Americans all the different groups.
Brilliant.
That's a fascinating book. Like, I think they should, if everyone read that, it'd be so different, because it's, yeah. That's a
I'm going to add it to my reading list now. I'll actually do the same. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate this conversation, Mark. You know, I think it's a timely conversation. I think it makes me feel better that I have been much more uncomfortable lately, right? Having these conversations with, you know, management and directors and senior managers and just within my communities. And sometimes I'm like, man, am I going to get fired for this? You know?
But, yeah, I get that. Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the end of the day, like, you know, if a company does fire me for that, then like maybe it's not the best company anyways, right? In a way, it's like, you know, just as long as I stand for who I am, who I want to be for the world, like, you know, that's important.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, that's a very courageous view of it. And not everybody's willing to take that that level of stand. So thank you for that willingness and for that courage. Yeah, and I think that more people being willing to do that and take that position, if there are more people who are willing to do that, the more chance we have of this actually making a difference.
Yeah, anyone, I would recommend Accomplishment Coaching. Anyone who wants to step up and be uncomfortable all the time, AC, Accomplishment Coaching being led by Mark Hunter and other leaders is the way to go. Shameless plug, Accomplishment Coaching.
Thanks for that.
Well, any last minute summaries or anything you want to leave people with?
You know, I just want to say thank you. You know, thank you, Davidson, for having this conversation. To anybody listening, thank you for being willing to listen to this conversation this far. Like, you know, it's that commitment. It's that level of willingness to be uncomfortable, to be made to feel uncomfortable, to look in the dark corners of that closet that I think is going to have us have all this make a difference and have this not be for naught. So thank you for Davidson for starting this and for having this and inviting me. And thanks everybody who's listening for listening, because I think that listening is what actually makes the difference. So thank you.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to reach out to Mark, what are some ways they could reach out to you?
Yeah. Great. Best way to reach out to me is by email. It's Mark, M-A-R-K at pinnacle-coaching.net.
Perfect. Okay. I'll link your email, and thank you so much for your presence, your leadership, and just for taking a stand in the world. And yeah, you inspire us all. So thanks, Mark. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Davidson. Appreciate you too. And thanks for having me.
Well, that's it, folks. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe and let me know what your thoughts are. If there were any takeaways, I welcome all positive and constructive feedback and hope you enjoy. Enjoy. Stay tuned for more interesting stories and guests. Take care.